Hello and welcome to Wisdom Talks, the podcast accompanying the Metis Project, the internet portal for intercultural wisdom literature and wisdom practices, to be found on www.ethz.ch. Today's episode addresses a topic that is all too present in the media: war. For millions of people, war has become part of their daily lives. Some are actively involved in warfare, others are aiding on the sidelines, providing first aid, sourcing clothes, preparing food and medication. Others, again, are setting up centers for people returning, carrying mental and physical scars for life. War is experienced on different levels of proximity, not only on the battlefield, but beyond. Civilians are caught in the crossfire when they are in the wrong place at the wrong time, when loved ones or they themselves are hurt or killed. Where does war begin geographically? Can we draw a line? Is there an emotional beginning of war? Does war exist for the lucky ones, us here in the studio in Zurich, for example, who are recording this podcast in a peaceful environment? To discuss these different levels of war proximity and perception, Olivier de Fabro joins me for this talk. He has recently visited different regions in the Ukraine as a freelance journalist and experienced war to different degrees of intensity and immediacy. Olivier is a senior research assistant in philosophy at ETH Zurich and is currently working on the many facets of the philosophy of war. Olivier, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I consider myself very fortunate. I only know about war from history books, newspaper reports, and stories. My grandparents all experienced the Second World War differently, but all from what we now know was at a safe distance in Switzerland. When I think about the war in Ukraine and the discussions about it in the media, it seems very close. It is taking place in Europe, and we're flooded with images and video material on social media and in the news. Still, I have the luxury to just detach myself from the topic of war if I wish to do so by blocking out information sources. But you, Olivier, you did not hide away here. Rather, you went to Ukraine for research purposes and as a journalist. So my opening question is, where does the war actually begin, and specifically the war in Ukraine?
I think that's a very good question. It's a difficult question, and I would say that for me and also for Ukraine, I would say that war is some sort of a space. So it has a spatial dimension. You could say it's a topos, it's some sort of a territory, or it happens on a territory. And within that space, many people are affected. Civilians, children and elderly, mothers and fathers, but also cultural infrastructure, homes, schools, but also animals and nature, as we've seen with the explosion of the Kharkovka Dam. So it's a bit of a different interpretation of war as, for example, Clausewitz would give, where you have two armies, two parties fighting each other like two wrestlers, and the aim of one party is to subdue the other and vice versa by physical force. So it's not just these two armies, even though, of course, in Ukraine you have soldiers as well. But for me, it's more of a space, right? And you can inflate that space by, or the war radiates, if you look at it economically and politically, it goes beyond the borders. This is what we usually know from international media, from mass media. But obviously, once you go into that war zone or into that space, you become part of it.
When do you think you became part of the war when you traveled to Ukraine? Or was it even earlier when you started preparing? Is there a beginning of war in that sense?
I'd say that for me, it got real when I started to prepare, just like you just said, when I took the decision to go. Obviously, you can always change your decisions, right? You can always interrupt the planning and say, okay, no, I changed my mind. But psychologically, it's much more complex. Once you decide to go, once you make all the preparations, you build this narrative around your actions and your decisions, and then it gets much more difficult to withdraw from that. But obviously, the closer you get to Ukraine, to that space, the more real it gets. Like you see the soldiers on the borders, you see the destroyed houses, you got the air alerts in the cities. You got the different checkpoints that you have to pass. In some cases, you got artillery fire that you hear, depending on where you are. Some hear the drones, which I didn't. So the closer you get, the more real it gets, yeah.
And so you physically went there. You went to closer proximity of these war circles that you've been describing, and then you actually started talking to various civilians in Ukraine. Could you maybe describe how you actually came to meet those people? How did you get in touch with your interviewees, and what kind of people did you talk to?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of organization, it's you always start very simple. Like, you know people, you know some Ukrainians, then you ask them, I don't know, they know somebody else, they are maybe involved in helping or whatever. And then, you know, you build a network from there. You got some ideas what you want to report on, which I had. And then, you know, you test your ideas and you go from there. So it's always a bit learning by doing. You learn by experience and you just go along. For me, it was very clear from the beginning that I wanted to interview also civilians and not just soldiers and not just report what's happening on the front line. Specifically because, as I just said, war for me is the space where a lot of, you could say, actors are affected, right? Not just human beings, but also nature and so on. That was why I wanted to cover this variety of victims. So, for example, one of the type of people that I interviewed was children in Kherson, who lived for about a year or so, if I remember correctly, under Russian occupation. And what struck me most was how children perceive not only war, but reality differently. Like, there's a certain innocence to it, and we know this, but it makes it also unbearable to see them suffer. And it has to do, I think, because they are very straightforward and honest. And I remember now that it was very difficult for me to give them a voice, right? Because they are very factual when they tell you what they experienced. And at the same time, and that's what makes it so unbearable to see them suffer, what gives them this innocence is that you can see in their, let's say, their gaze, their gestures, the way they act, that something happened. So the war left a trace, but they can't really put it into words. And there was one example of what I did there. Or another one was where I interviewed women who were either pregnant or had children and had to flee from the front line and from occupation. And what struck me most there was, I don't like to use that word that much, but their survival instinct, like the way they were ready to flee and to take care of their children, the need for protection there. Obviously, it makes sense, but the determination that they had and the sentiment of that they had for belonging together, like what we probably would call a family.
I would like to ask a follow-up question here, because this is something we don't read in the daily news. We read the more factual, is not the right word, but we read what concerns us also politically. And we get these very dry reports. But what you're telling us now is that there are so many people involved in those different layers of war that we've been trying to tap into now. And so concerning the children, and also you talk to teenagers as well, and the women that were also pregnant, those are very different dimensions. And so what I would like to ask here is, do they talk about war in a similar sense as the soldiers, for example, that you also talked to that were on the front? Or do they have a different perception of war because it's removed but not less emotionally touching?
It's a very good question. I would say that they more or less talked the same, to be honest, except for the children. But they all felt that this was an unjust war, that Russia is the aggressor, it's unjustified. They felt, to some extent, humiliated because they experienced occupation. They were badly treated. For example, at checkpoints, men had to strip naked to show if they had national tattoos of Ukraine. And the same counts for the soldiers. So they also think it's an unjust war. They also thought that they had to enroll. And many of the women that I interviewed are also now doing volunteer work. And they see themselves also as struggling and fighting and helping. Obviously, not at all in the same sense as if they would be fighting on the front line, but there is a collective resistance there, I would say. At least the people I talk to, obviously, there's also negative parts or negative sides to Ukraine. But it's a lot about self-organization and helping each other. That's what I experienced.
And now you said that there's a similar narrative or a similar sense also, perception of war in that sense. But I still would like to know, are there differences in the descriptions as you move through the country, if you're moving closer to the front line or whether you're still further to the east? So in a geographical sense, do you feel the different layers of war again there?
Yes, I would say so, because very clearly people who either lived in the east and lost their homes and cannot go back, or have lived under occupation for some time, or are still living there and hear the bombings and the shootings and so on every day, for them it makes a huge difference compared to those who have always been, let's say, living in the West and were not that much affected. Even though I met people in the West who were very engaged and very wanted to help, right? But it's the Eastern Ukraine is obviously much more affected by, and in this sense, again, as a space, the people who live there, as Western Ukraine, I would say, yes.
Now, when you went east, you, and of course, then also perceived these changes in emotions and immediacy. And in a previous podcast, or a previous episode of this podcast, we spoke to Daniel Trussillo about his deployment to Iraq. So I'm making a bit of an excursion here. And he described this time as a state of constant, intense alertness and tension. Did you have this same feeling that the closer you got to the front line, the more alert you were constantly, that there was this very specific atmosphere?
Absolutely. I mean, the more you are in a war zone, the more you get used to it. In this sense, it's no different than any other liminal experience. I mean, the German Grenzerfahrung, right, in which you are exposed to, let's say, possible death or danger. So you get used to it, but at the beginning, it's very intense. And for me, it was even very intense, actually, because I went two times, and the first time I went was more intense for me than the second time, even though the first time I was only moving in Western Ukraine. So it was a kind of an initiation to it, but it's very intense. There's constant tension and alertness. And last but not least, also because you know that Russians are not just attacking soldiers, not just people in uniform, but also civilians and journalists. So you are as much a target, well, you can be as much a target as a soldier. So not wearing a uniform doesn't really help you. Maybe one anecdote, when I arrived in Kherson after we passed a couple of checkpoints, we stopped at a petrol station in the city to get some coffee, to get some drinks. And the moment I got out of the car, let's say about 15 to 20 seconds, I heard the first artillery fire. And just to make clear, it's artillery fire that's not directed towards the city. So the Ukrainian artillery are hiding in the fields and the woods somewhere outside of Kherson and are firing at the Russians who are on the other side of the river. And it's counter battery fire, so they're trying to locate each other and fire at each other. And that's what you hear. And you are in the middle between these two artillery units, and you hear them firing at each other all the time. But the first time you hear it, it's a very significant noise that you won't forget and that you also recognize immediately. And in that moment, first of all, I knew that I had to take a decision. Well, that's how I felt. I was thinking, okay, either you go back now and it's fine, or you stay and you stay the week that I was there and you make your peace with your fate and, you know, whatever happens, happens, and you do the work that you decided to do there. And then I talked to one of the people that I was there with and I asked him, that's artillery fire, right? And he said, yes, exactly. He's been there a couple of times already. And he told me, don't worry, you get used to it by an hour or so. And then I was still thinking about stuff and decided to stay though, but you know, thoughts just go along, and we were driving around and I met new people and so on and so forth. And after an hour or so, I heard another explosion, so another artillery fire. And I looked at my watch and I saw that exactly 1 hour had passed and that I actually almost got used to it. And so he was kind of right. Like, you, the more you dare, you get used to it. But sometimes, you know, when you hear it again, you still think about it and so on. So, you know, it's always this in between, I would say.
Is there in that sense also a kind of numbness that reaches you at one point?
I think this can happen. It didn't happen to me. I think I wasn't long enough there to get into that specific state. But when I observed, for example, children playing, and that I also interviewed in Kherson, in the city itself, for them it was just normal. It was just, they were used to it. I think it would even be, for them, a peaceful situation would even be rather an exception.
So getting back to the children in that sense, do you think that children can adapt quickly, right? Especially if they have these secure points, their mothers that are taking care of them, for example. I'm saying specifically mothers because those are the most examples that you also gave in your interviews. So do you think that for them, being this war situation, as bizarre as it is, it has reached some kind of normal that they can cope with?
I would say so, yeah. So while I was doing the interviews, for example, in the countryside where the children lived, where I also went, the countryside around Kherson, we constantly could hear the artillery fire, but more at a distance. They were playing around. They were happy also because it was organized by the humanitarian aid group that I was there with. So they had a good time also. Because it was, just as a parenthesis, it was important for these children to learn to play again. Because during the Russian occupation, they could not do that. They were starting to play war, actually. They were starting to play, you know, checkpoint and so on. So it was important that they learn to play with soccer and, I don't know, learn other games, you know, instead of war. They were imitating basically the environment that they were living in. And that's also more of the problem with children, I think. While they were living under occupation, they were really having a bad time, like an awful time, because they couldn't get out of the house. The Russian army that was occupying them was under attack by the Ukrainians. But once the Russians left, they were obviously happy and they could live a more or less normal life again. But it's not normal, right? School is still not really, school's out. So what I want to say is, I think for them, it was important that they could be more peaceful with their families in an environment in which they are not threatened directly. So it was more important for them to get out of the occupation. And now the whole still living on the front line is something that you accept, but it's a much better situation for them.
And now that we are moving closer to the front line, I would like to ask you to talk a bit about the interviews that you had with the soldiers that were severely wounded in action, because you talked to a couple of them also, and what it meant for them that they may never be able to go and fight again. And now, from my very distant point of view, I would think that would be great, right? You survive, but you don't have to go into action again. But was this the case?
Right. So Denis is 22 years old. Vitaly is 25 years old. Both lost limbs due to grenade explosions. Denis lost one of his arms and still has problems walking because his hip has been injured as well. And Vitaly lost a leg. I would say, to answer your question, that was the fact that they cannot go back and fight was at the very beginning a problem for them. They got injured in August 23. And right now for them, they recovered well. And right now for them, it's they accepted the fact that they cannot go back and fight. But as far as I know, Vitaly is still working with prosthesis to walk and so on. And Dennis works for the military again. I mean, he is a soldier, so, but he works more, let's say, in the back office, not the front line.
And what made them, of course, they were enrolled, they were soldiers, so it was also their obligation to go. But did they talk about this first step of entering active warfare?
Yeah, I mean, for both of them, it was actually some sort of a patriotism, not in a highly ideological sense, but they believed in the independence of Ukraine and they wanted to serve. And for them, it was a duty that they had to fulfill. Dennis was, I think he entered the military when he was 19, and Vitaly joined a volunteer militia even before Kiev was being attacked. So for them, it was kind of a natural thing to do. It could not have been otherwise. Russia is the aggressor. Ukrainians want to be independent, and they don't want to live under Russian occupation.
So it is a bit comparable to the situation with the children, that it's just suddenly the new reality, and you don't reflect too deeply about it because that's just the way it is and you need to cope with it. And what I'm always wondering about, because of course I didn't do any military service either, so for me this closeness to death and dying, and then also connected to this, of course, killing, is what I find difficult to grasp. How can you get into a situation where this suddenly becomes not okay? It's never okay, but something that you can imagine doing. Did they ever talk about this, the fact that they went out and had to engage in these horrible tasks?
Yeah, I mean, Vitaly talked a little bit about it, but for him, he was very, objective and distant to it. So for him, doing this, becoming a soldier and defending and killing, for him was like a job. It was what he had to do, and he had to follow his orders. That's what he said to me. And there's nothing else to discuss. The way he copes with it personally, that he had to do this, and also Dennis, I have not talked to them about this. And I think this is also what I know from literature, at least. It's very different for different people. Depends what you experienced, depends what your belief system is, and so on and so forth. And if you can better or worse cope with it.
And I know you mentioned the word belief system, and I would like to know, did they talk about any belief systems that they followed, something more than having this sense of duty to protect the country? And did they maybe also use literature to cope with this difficult or bizarre also situation?
Yeah, that's a good question. That was very interesting for me to experience when I met them, because I didn't know this, of course, beforehand, right? It's always interesting when, as a journalist, you find out what people actually tell you then once you talk to them. And for Dennis, literature and philosophy played a very important role, especially since he got wounded. And he talked to me about Erich Maria Remarque, All Quiet on the Western Front. That's a book that was very important for him, because the way Remarque described the emotions in the war experience, he could very much, he agreed with this. He felt that Remarque was describing it the way what he experienced as well. On the other hand, he also wanted to highlight that Remarque was fighting a war on a different territory, right? He went from Germany to France to fight there, whereas he was fighting on his own territory, defending his territory. So there's also a difference there that he made me aware of. He also told me that he likes to read Cormac McCarthy. So, for example, The Road or other, let's say, apocalyptic literature, which I also found interesting. And Vitaly was more of a, I would say, a religious person. He's very Christian. He believes in God. And he also told me that when he got wounded, he was conscious, in contrast to Dennis, who lost consciousness. And Vitaly was in the trench with a fellow soldier who also got injured, and both of them kept fighting. So their unit was gone, but both of them were left there in the trench, and they kept firing with a machine gun at the Russians who were approaching. And he told me that he just did his duty, his work was his responsibility, and he was ready to die. And he said that it's God's will, basically. His fate lies in God's hands. So he was a very religious person in this sense. And you could also sense it when you talked to him.
So the two soldiers seem to have been very open, judging from what you just said, in explaining their... I mean, this is deeply personal, right? To explain how you cope with intense emotions. So was that the case? Were they open to talk about their experiences, or was it difficult to do this interview with them?
No, not at all. It was not difficult at all. They were very objective about it. No tears. Very realistic. Very straightforward. It was rather me who had to, you know, try to... You don't want to have it too emotional, right? But you also don't want to have it, the interview, you also don't want to have it too objective, too much facts. So it was rather me who was trying to pinpoint them at more of an emotional side. But yeah.
Do you think it might also be helpful for them to know that their story and their experiences are being told? Because oftentimes, coming from a historical perspective, it's these people who've had this big mass, if we want to call it that, are often not heard as much as the big decision makers whose voices we do then in hindsight hear more. Do you think it was important for these soldiers now, but also for the children that you interviewed, the mothers that you interviewed, to be heard?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And that's also why I like to interview these kind of people, because I think it's important that their voice is heard and they think it themselves. Many of the, that was back in February a year ago when I interviewed these women with their children, many times they told me, when you go back, you have to tell the truth about what is happening here. And their storytelling basically became this truth, and the truth itself of what happens there, the facts, is connected to this, what I said earlier about justice and this unjust war. So they connected all of this together. For them, it was... What I want to say is, for them, it was very important that they could tell their story. It's not that they were, you know, pushy or anything, but they really wanted to tell what they experienced and what they saw. And I think for Vitaly and Denis, it was the same. It was actually more of a coincidence that I interviewed Vitaly and Denis, because meanwhile, she's a friend in Ukraine, Irina. She told me about these two soldiers, and if I wanted to interview them, I could do that. And so I went there and I did. So, but I'm really happy I did. So it's them who approached me that they wanted to talk about this.
I'm continuing to think along the lines of being close geographically again to war, and I'm moving away a bit more. And the people we haven't talked yet about, and there are so many groups we could still talk about, but you just alluded to them, are the mothers. Specifically, women with children. Could you maybe talk a bit about the interviews you had with them and how they tell this story?
The mothers I interviewed was interesting so far that most of them had to flee from Eastern Ukraine to Western Ukraine. Some of them even went for a while to Europe, because when I interviewed them, the war had been going on for a year. And they basically told me their journey. I still have to think a lot about one of the women, which was Ilona. She's she's in her early 30s, if I remember correctly. She has 4 or 5 kids. And when the war broke out, she was in Tokmak, which is still today under Russian occupation. And she lived for a while under Russian occupation. There was no running water, and she had a newborn baby. She was only with that child. The other children that she had were in safety in Western Ukraine. And she, because of so much stress, she couldn't breastfeed her baby. And So she had to filter out the water from the radiator to mix it with formula in order to feed the infant. And she has a remarkable story because she fled through all these different checkpoints under also bombardment by Russian jets. And she just threw herself on the ground, covering her baby. Nothing happened, obviously. She survived. And I still have to think a lot about her because her husband is fighting in the army. She is herself a soldier, but because she just had a baby, she was off duty. And I still have to think a lot about her because Tokmak is still under occupation and she left her parents there. I mean, the parents of her husband. So her in-laws. And I still think a lot about her because she's her husband especially, and they still want to reunite with their family, with their parents. And I think it's so symbolic because it also tells you what we hear in the news, that Ukrainians don't want to stop fighting. And it's precisely because of this. It's precisely because families have been torn apart and they want to get back together. And why should we tell them to stop, right?
Now, the stories you're telling, they're incredibly, well, horrible, impressive in the sense that what these people are going through and how they're dealing with is quite remarkable and something that I don't even want to imagine myself to be in. And so just specifically because of that, because these are such bizarre situations and you would think, how can this happen? And it's been happening for thousands of years that people have engaged in war time and time again. I would like to go now into the more theoretical part of this wisdom talk and ask, how do maybe different writers, philosophers reflect on these things happening, even though if you tell all these stories, you think this cannot happen. It's so bizarre and hurts so many people. This should never even start. Are there any texts that reflect on why wars begin and why they continue to begin?
Right. So I mentioned Clausewitz earlier. He was a Prussian commander fighting in the Napoleonic Wars on the side of Prussia and Russia. He experienced war, obviously, firsthand. And he's well known in, let's say, philosophy and theory of war because he wrote down not necessarily what he experienced, but theoretically what war for him meant and strategy and tactics and so on and so forth. And if war is a science, for example. But Clausewitz's book, it's called On War, Über Krieg, it's not so much of a theory that he presents. It's more a study. So he sees himself as a wise teacher, and the student, so the person who reads this book, should learn to self-teach. So what he wrote down for him was not something that you should take on the battlefield like a manual, and if this happens, then do that, and if this happens, then do that, and so on and so forth. But it was rather something that you read, and then you got some guidelines in order to self-teach. And one question, I already mentioned it, is there a science of war? And for Clausewitz, that is not the case. His most famous quote is probably that there's a fog of war. So we don't have enough data and information about what's going on. There's uncertainty. And that's because of what he calls friction in war. So aims and goals are hindered by obstacles. For example, the weather and time. So chance or danger, Gefahr, or physical exertion, right? You get tired physically and morally and mentally. So for Clausewitz, it's very important to distinguish between real war and war on paper. And what he tried to write down is what real war is about. So what you will experience, even though it's probably more on an abstract level than what he himself experienced, but it's to prepare yourself for this. And it's usually... it's rather directed towards commanders. So it's not so much civilians or soldiers, it's rather commanders. And for him, So war is not a science, it's rather an art. So you have to develop a certain skill in order to navigate through war. And that's also the metaphor that he uses. For him, a general is like a captain who has to steer his boat at night in the dark through a sea full of reefs. And that's what he presents his reader with. If you go one, let's say one level down, you got, for example, Carl Malantes, who was a Vietnam veteran, who wrote the book, What It Is Like to Go to War. He's a former Marine. He got diagnosed with PTSD, and he writes about homecoming. So for him, he writes about his war experience. It, for him, writing that book meant to come to terms with that war experience and to help others. He criticizes the government back then, political decisions, lying that happened, and so on and so forth. What it makes, what happens to soldiers if they are lied to by the government. And for him, the wisdom in war lies in when he talks about martial arts, which is very interesting to me because I practice martial arts as well. So I very much like that connection. For him, a soldier should live by a code, use it only in self-defense, use violence, excuse me, only in self-defense and respect of opponents. So there's this spiritual component to training and also killing. And that's what soldiers and warriors do in the end. They have to choose a side for him, and they have to acknowledge the fact that they might be killing other people. So for him, this whole book is about why do you kill if you're a soldier? How does it fit into the grand scheme of things, as he says? And how do you feel afterwards? And this book is a bit of a preparation for this. And then there's another book that, or another literature that comes to my mind, which is by Svetlana Alexeyevich, The Unwomanly Face of War, in which she interviews former female Soviet soldiers. Women have actually always participated in war in ancient times, and in the Soviet army in World War II, what she focuses on, around 1 million women fought, which is quite a significant number, I think. And the book is basically an oral history, and it's also about memory, about giving women a voice and how they describe their war, no heroism. Also, it's about reality, just as for Malantes and von Clausewitz. How, for example, these women had to leave their children back home, and when they came back from the front line, the children were older and didn't recognize their own mothers. How they felt when they had to kill. How they also were rejected by men who, after the war, wanted to have more, let's say, feminine women to fall in love with, and so on and so forth. So these three books come to my mind when I think of the different experiences that you can have in this space of war.
What I find very interesting in the three books that you mentioned is that they all take the fact that there is war as such. It is a fact and it just exists. I also think it's very interesting that you said that it has a very male character, even though many women are involved, be it that they're active soldiers, but also that they are the ones that often get violated if they're just at home trying to take care of things at home. So these are the things that I find interesting here, but I would actually like to take one step even further back. I do martial arts myself, and I am a woman, and I have problems combining two things, and that's just how does the fight even start? And this is ironic. If you do martial arts, you'd think, well, it's also a game. You start and you fight, and it's part of what you do. But I still have problems understanding this very first starting point. How does it begin? Does any one of those three books or others that you know reflect on how it can even happen that you can mobilize to such big groups, because wars may mostly have very large groups of people engaged in this? How does it start?
It's a very good question, and I think it's a very difficult question. I am personally more on the side of wars just there, it's a reality and we have to adapt to it and deal with it, some more, some less. It's very old and I don't think it's ever going to go away. And then, but in regard to your question, you have different possibilities of how to answer this. You can go on the psychological level, on the political level. If you want to discuss the reasons why there's war, I think you shift away from the topic of war and go more into the debate what violence is and how violence emerges. And then you have two possibilities. You can, roughly speaking, right? You have either the more biological, psychological explanation of it. Violence is something like an instinct, right? I want to survive and I don't know, mixed with other emotions, it can become, can turn into physical violence, fear, and so on. Or you have a more structural perspective, a more macroscopic perspective in which you say, well, societies, if they are not organized, well, people become aggressive and so on and so forth. And, you know, then it turns into violence. And war is in the end then a mass phenomena of violence. It's a huge outburst of physical and symbolic violence as well. And depending on what your moral belief is, you can go more to the pacifist direction or the more martial one. In pacifism, you got a lot of literature. You got Gandhi, you got Russell, you got Martin Luther King, you got Tolstoy.
So to capture what we talked about in this wisdom talk and connecting it to wisdom literature, I think we can say that the books that you talked about can be considered as wisdom literature because, as you said, war is, as sad as it is, as horrific it is to think about it, part of life. In this podcast, we're also trying to think about how can you lead a good life. Engaging in war is not what I would call a good life, but still it's something we need to deal with. So to ask a final question, would you say that engaging in or listening to voices that experience war like you did firsthand and also maybe read like me a bit more detached, read reports, listen to these voices that you recorded also, and then also reading literature, is this in a sense another kind of wisdom that we can use to deal with the world situation we're in now where wars seem to be constantly resurging also or new ones breaking out?
I would say so. And I think that it's very important that this literature exists. It is out there. It is very old. As I said, I don't think that war will disappear. And I think that wisdom lies exactly in acknowledging that fact. So that wars don't disappear and that it most probably will, never will. So I think that if you want to talk about moral progress, which a couple of people I would say do, a couple of intellectuals, that could help us to get rid of war, I think that wisdom should teach us that this is a foolishness. I think that Clausewitz, Melantis, and Alexievich can help us to understand this because they have experienced war or they have reported on it. And yeah, experience is very important. It's what should be first and not our moral convictions. I mean, I'm not pro-war, but I think it's foolish to think that you can just swipe it away. And the way I see the current state of events in the world, it's war is increasing. It's not, or these spaces of war are increasing. They are not going back.
And maybe as a very final question, although I think this is a topic that could be endlessly discussed, but when you came home to Switzerland, how did you deal with what you heard, what you saw? Was there any literature that helped you personally to cope with these things?
That's a good question. So when I came home, I was there for 2 weeks. When I went there for the second time, I was there for 2 weeks doing two interviews per day. And you know how exhausting an interview can be. So, and that in a war zone. So I was completely exhausted afterwards. And I was basically lying on my couch for a week or so. And I needed to relax and shut down. And I started a couple of books reading that I thought might help me, especially literature, but it just didn't. And what really, really helped me was, and it's kind of weird, was Spinoza's Ethics, which is, if you know that book, it's a very, very abstract book. It has definitions and proofs and so on. So it's very, the structure is very logical and almost mathematical. And it's very abstract. It's about God, and which is a substance, which he calls a substance, and its nature and reality. And then you have different modi and so on, and attributes. But it helped me dealing with that situation, because I could, on an abstract level, connect everything with everything. So it made sense. The whole journey made sense to me when I read Spinoza.
I think I will take this personal anecdote as an ending to this very, very dense, very thought-provoking. I think this is something that I will think about for a while now, as well as an ending point and maybe as a motivation to try to read Spinoza again to see what I can find in there. And I'll thank you very much for sharing all these experiences and thoughts with us.
Thank you.
So we have unfortunately reached the time limit for this Wisdom Talk, a conversation that could go on for far longer. I would like to thank Olivier de Fabre for taking the time to share his experiences and pass on the stories of the people experiencing war in Ukraine. Thank you also for listening to our talk, to these stories. And I would like to invite you to follow further Wisdom Talks, as well as to curiously plunge into the multitude of texts and further podcasts that can be found on our website, www.metis.ethz.ch, the internet portal for intercultural wisdom, literature, and wisdom practices. You can also find more information in the show notes. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye. This Metis Wisdom Talk was produced by Martin Münich and supported by ETH Zürich and the Udo Keller Stiftung Forum Humanum in Hamburg.